Birth, Chapter 21. 6 a.m. came earlier than usual for the new president. Riker had barely closed his eyes after the meeting deep below the White House with Hadid, John, and Enoch. Just when he was coming to terms with the reality that he had won the most improbable election in history, the weight of what they had told him changed everything. This was perhaps the final generation of people on the Earth. He actually enjoyed the challenge of politics and the campaign solutions he had recorded on YouTube and used to fill in the content gap that formed in the wasteland between the two parties. It had only been a couple of months, but he was already beginning to like this job. He was able to help people and prevent calamity between nations. He had already spoken to the leaders of Russia, China, Germany, and various special interest groups in the U.S. His ideas for making the world a better place had little to do with feeding the needs of these people. It had much more to do with actually dismantling the power the agencies had over the world. After all, the secretaries worked for him, and they ran each of the agencies, departments, bureaus, and administrations. If he told them to stop enforcing certain aspects of their regulations, they had to do it. It was a good place to start, he thought. His first meeting this morning was with the Joint Chiefs, seasoned military guys from each branch of the National Defense. There was enough power in that room to destroy the world a few times over. "Mr. President," they all said in some sort of unison as he came into the room. It was a sign of respect, but he came to terms with the fact that they really did not respect him. Well, maybe the Admiral. When he shook his hand, he seemed to mean it. Admiral Samuel Dinetti expressed his concern over coffee once about this whole force being exposed at sea in international or even hostile waters. Sam and Robert looked at one another when the intelligence briefing they attended revealed that the Chinese had a surface-to-surface type drone that could cruise at 600 miles an hour and then suddenly accelerate to 4,000 miles an hour just yards off the surface of the water. At that speed, ship radar would only have about 20 seconds to lock on and fire countermeasures. If this modern-day kamikaze drone was in the process of accelerating, it was nearly impossible to intercept. They were capable of carrying nuclear warheads as well. That meant that if the warhead detonated within a mile of the ship, they were all dead. If it hit the ship, it would take 45 minutes for the seawater to fill in the hole left behind. There was a mutual bond after that coffee. "The world is a dangerous neighborhood," said the 4-star General Daniel D. Cabarrus. The U.S. Army seemed to be transforming itself again. They had Rangers and Special Forces and something the CIA called Special Action Agents that made them operate more like assassins than soldiers. Presidents had been asking for a killing machine with no fingerprints for a long time. His father had told him when he was young never to trust someone who would steal for you. His gut told him to never trust anyone who would assassinate for you. I guess there was a reason why historical armies lined up and shot at one another or charged at one another across the frozen tundra with battle axes. There was honor in that style of fighting. Still, he shuddered at the thought of being immersed in that much fear and that much anger and blood all day, every day, until the leader of the other side turned his horse around and went home. The records were full of wars like this, lasting for years or even decades. Something or someone kept them breeding and training more soldiers. Each era, the weapons on one side would match the weapons on the other side, and they would fight until the mothers of lost sons would pressure their leaders that they could bear no more. The Dark Prince's progeny mastered the art of complete female suppression. They would mutilate them while they were still children and deny them education. They would beat them and celebrate public executions for girls or women who opened their mouths against their husbands. They were taught the value of oil and the skill of bribery and deception. Within a few generations, men and women learned to make themselves exceedingly wealthy from these dark lords and their blood-stained gold and diamonds. They sold their districts and their cities and their states and finally their countries. For a while, it seemed, there were men of honor who would discover these syndicates and put them in jail or execute them for treason. But those men grew old and tired. Within a few decades, the reign of the judges was secure. They would issue their rulings as instructed by the agents of the Dark Prince. Faithful people were executed or targeted by various government agencies for malicious litigation or acts of terrorism perpetrated by their own government. It became apparent that nothing could be done to stop them. So these briefings with the Joint Chiefs were formal and scheduled and completely ineffectual. At times he felt like he was being sold the next regime change or the next trillion-dollar weapon system that would give them an advantage in the neighborhood. "What is your biggest fear?" he had asked them once. "You mean, who do we fear the most?" they responded. "Yes, I mean, we have been fighting a bunch of mountain men on Honda 125 motorcycles and with used unarmored pickup trucks that with untrained gunners standing in the back. They have no tanks. They have no airplanes. They have no ships. They have no satellite intelligence or joint chiefs. And yet, they have been kicking your asses for 30 years. You seem to like it, because the checks are still cashing. Who do you really fear? The Russians? The Chinese? The Indians?" He was emotional and realized that they had been yelled at before by presidents. They would lock shields, it seemed, to protect one another and not let any one person be singled out for that ass-chewing. "Well, no, Mr. President. What we have, they have. What they have, we will have soon. The biggest fear is the American people." He was shocked to hear this from Cabarrus. Admiral Donetti looked at him. Riker looked at him. "I'm not sure I understand." "No, you wouldn't, sir," he said, leaning forward now. "Leadership is about control. All those battlefields you mentioned are in control," he argued. "In control? You come in here on a weekly basis and tell me of casualties and budget items and skirmishes and sorties, and you say this is all in control? When did it become all right to maintain an endless battle and never have a war? When did it become the goal to continuously fight and never seek surrender? Peace is supposed to come after victory, gentlemen. When are we going to have victory?" "It never has worked like that, sir," spat Cabarrus. "The Great War didn't end all wars. It just ended wars like those. We don't fight uniforms anymore. We fight ghosts. We fight preachers and zealots. Our steel and titanium is useless against them. Sometimes I feel like the British felt when this nation was formed." "What's that supposed to mean?" asked Riker, leading him into his own resignation. "The British commanded the finest, richest, and most well-armed fighting force on Earth at the time. The colonies mustered an army of farmers and lumberjacks. They changed the way war was fought for thousands of years. They hid behind trees and hid behind children and women in plain sight. They shot soldiers in the back, poisoned their water, and wore them down over a period of years by leading them into the wilderness and slaughtering them." "Does that sound familiar?" retorted Cabarrus. "I see what you're saying," capitulated Riker. Cabarrus was not as dumb as he looked. He was battle-hardened and had more medals on his chest than he could fathom. But it appeared he was a historian as well. Patton, he thought. Great movie. Sad end to a brilliant warrior. He could hear the frustration in the general's voice. He was at a loss of what to say. You said you feared the American people a minute ago. Why? Asked Riker. I'm not afraid of them for me, Mr. President. I'm afraid of them for you. We will just be called to fight the war, he said. Me? Well, not you per se, entered Donetti. There are really two governments in our country. One is elected. They get the blame when things go badly. And you, Mr. President, you get the blame too, he began. Then there's the other government that really took form in 1933 with Roosevelt. You remember the crash. Donetti was going to tell a story, so Riker slumped slightly in his chair. He realized he'd been stiff and tense the entire time Cabarrus was talking. Today, there are more than 655 agencies, all of which write regulations that have the force of law. They tax and fine, confiscate property, and rule over the people and consume 90% of the national budget. And none of them are elected. That, Mr. President, is taxation without representation. Tyranny. And the American people still will not tolerate tyranny. And there are 150 million of them, all armed, many hundreds of thousands of them trained by us, said Cabarrus. You think we have problems with a few thousand insurgents on mopeds with AK-47s? Just wait until the citizens begin marching on the Capitol, said Cabarrus coldly. That's never going to happen, said Donetti. My sources tell me otherwise, and we need to be prepared. Prepared to do what? Asked Riker. Just prepared, Mr. President, said Cabarrus stiffly. If you're saying that federal troops would ever be used against the American people on American soil, I believe that is not constitutional, said Riker. Yeah? Well, insurrection is also mentioned in that document. When a governor asks for help from the president to put down an insurrection, you have to send in federal troops to put it down, said Cabarrus. Oh, like Lincoln? That was called an insurrection too, you know, responded Riker. Well, at least you're getting the picture, Mr. President, said Cabarrus with an edge to his voice. Okay, listen up, said Riker. I believe I was elected because the people were tired of the old one-party system. They were tired of the wholesale invasion of this country for the last 30 years by people who just stroll across our borders. They are tired of the spending and the perception that Washington was just taking away their liberty and offering an IOU on security. Now you're trying to tell me that the real threat to America is the American people? Well, I'm not buying it. I can tell you it is hard to get the American people to get together on anything or come out for anything, let alone vote. But when they do come out in masses, we are not going to fight them. We are going to listen to them, because they probably have a legitimate grievance. The fact that they are armed is supposed to remind us that it's our job to listen to them. We are serving at their pleasure. Riker knew he was right, but he wasn't changing the minds at this table. These men were stalwarts in their religions of war and using force or the threat of force to achieve their goals. He feared the only thing he had accomplished was establishing himself as their enemy as well, especially General Cabarrus. He glanced up at Hadid, scanning the room from the edge of the wallpaper in the room. He had perhaps heard these words before with other presidents. Maybe not. Maybe he'd heard worse. He wondered if there would be another pre-dawn coaching session in the bowels of the White House. Thank you all for coming, said the president. No one said another word as they stood and left the room. He was at least secure in the thought that the codes to launch any kind of weapon rested with him. The thought made him cold inside, but he was convinced now more than ever that there was great wisdom to be revered. That kind of wisdom does not come from men, he thought. Now, the only thing he had to do was not be tricked into betraying that wisdom.